ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Global roaming is expanding to weekdays on ABC Radio National.
Global events, well, they're coming too thick and fast.
We're delivering 5 days a week.
The issues, the challenges are serious, but our aim always is to make it a conversation we can all share. I'm Hamish McDonald.
I'm Geraldine Doogue, and now joined by esteemed colleagues Latika Burke and Kylie Morris.
Global Roaming.
Search for Global Roaming on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Just like in the wake of Challenger 17 years earlier, it took time to work out the exact cause of the Columbia space shuttle disaster.
As the shuttle broke apart, re-entering the Earth's atmosphere on February 1, 2003, debris rained down on the southern United States.
Authorities are still desperately searching for the wreckage, using everything from horses to satellites to track it down.
And this debris is crucial to piece together what had happened.
I became so impassioned. I've got to do something. I cannot sit here. I got to do something. And I want to figure out what happened, fix this, and we got to do what's right.
Before the disaster, NASA's Mike Cinelli had been part of the engineering team working on the Columbia shuttle. He then began leading a search and recovery team in rural Texas.
One moment you're a launch guy, right, that's launching a rocket. Now you're finding yourself in the back of a helicopter with the doors off, looking out, and you're trying to spot artifacts from the air. So it was a roller coaster ride of emotions was probably the best way to describe it.
It took months to recover the Columbia debris, along with the human remains of the 7 astronauts who had died. After the long and grueling task, the space shuttle was reconstructed piece by piece in a huge hangar in Florida, allowing investigators to begin their work.
And there were a few guesses already emerging at this point as to what had actually caused the accident.
And one of them was to do with foam. Remember the insulating piece of foam that cameras had captured breaking off the external fuel tank and hitting the shuttle wing.
NASA has already begun its investigation. The immediate focus is on the possible damage to the protective thermal tiles on Columbia's left wing.
And yet, despite the attention that this foam strike drew during the mission, after the accident,
it was stated even by program leadership that it cannot be the foam. The foam could not have caused this accident. But that really set us thinking, it can't be the foam. Look somewhere else.
There was a perception from some that foam, a very lightweight material, couldn't cause such catastrophic damage.
As one person told me, it's like a styrofoam cooler blowing off a pickup truck on the highway. It may cause a cloud, but it causes no damage. It can't have the force or the impact. But no one had ever tested it.
Until they did test it.
Which made it quite clear, absolutely irrefutable, what happened.
So after 2 catastrophic disasters, 17 years apart, what was going on internally at NASA? And could it be fixed?
Most disasters are not act of God events. In other words, where they're just a fluke, a chance, a weird thing. They're systematic errors that are made along the way.
And would this be the last of the close calls and accidents for the space shuttle program?
So we were asked, how do you as a crew feel about the fact that foam fell off of your fuel tank when that was the same thing that caused the Columbia accident?
In the 40 years since the Challenger disaster, sociologists, engineers, and those directly involved have studied the intricate details of these events. Because beyond the mechanical issues, NASA's internal organizational workings represent a lesson for us all.
We can all relate to this idea of being in a system where some people have more power than we do and where we might be motivated, you know, to do what the system wants us to do, not what's the right thing to do.
This is The Challenger Legacy, a 5-part series of science fiction from ABC Radio National. I'm Dr. Carl.
And I'm Fiona Pepper. Episode 4, The Devil You Know. CNN CNN aerospace correspondent Miles O'Brien vividly remembers when Columbia accident investigators carried out foam testing. It was a test that would blow that assumption, the idea that foam strikes couldn't cause damage, wide open.
They finally did what they should have done. They fired a big piece of foam at a piece of that reinforced carbon-carbon, that leading edge of the wing, and wham, there was a manhole size hole in the wing, and it just, it hit me like a ton of bricks. It hit the whole space community like a ton of bricks. It was just so obvious that this organization of brilliant engineers had missed something very obvious and very dangerous.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. Fee, I'm just totally astonished that a bunch of foam can make a hole as big as a human head. Man, that stuff must have been moving so fast.
Yeah, so those tests showed that foam travelling at 850 kilometres an hour could cause significant damage.
So if NASA had approved the satellite imagery during the Columbia mission, the engineers may well have had a very clear idea of what they were actually dealing with.
Absolutely. And then in August 2003, the official report of the Columbia Accident Investigation Board, or CABE, confirmed the foam strike on launch as the cause of the disaster.
The report confirms what's been widely accepted, that a piece of foam hit the shuttle's wing, piercing its heat shield. But that was only partly to blame.
NASA had conflicting goals of cost, schedule, and safety. And unfortunately, safety lost out in a lot of areas to the mandates of operational requirements.
So, Phoebe, a burning question from me. So, the foam strike, it hits Columbia's wing on launch, and NASA decide not to image the shuttle, so they never know that it had a problem until the re-entry 16 days later. And if they had done that imaging, well, would it have made any difference? Could they have saved the crew?
So this was something the Columbia Accident Investigation Board, or CABE, looked at in depth. And the conclusion that they came to was, no, the crew couldn't be saved.
What? They couldn't set up a rescue shuttle? They couldn't do a repair on the run?
No. So without going into heaps of detail, basically a rescue shuttle was seen as logistically impossible, and the Columbia crew weren't equipped to repair the wing from space.
Mate, that is so heartbreaking. They were up there for over 2 weeks, 16 days, in space, and they didn't know that they were never going to make it home.
I know. So NASA couldn't have saved the Columbia crew from that particular foam strike. But as we've learned, foam strikes were a known problem, and that's where you really start to see the parallels with Challenger. So one of the people who testified in the Columbia investigation was sociologist Diane Vaughan. Diane described these parallels, or what she calls echoes, between Challenger and Columbia. Here's a recording of that testimony at the CABE hearings back in 2003.
What the echoes mean is that the problems that existed at the time of Challenger have not been fixed, despite all the resources and all the insights the Presidential Commission found, that these problems have still remain. And so one of the things that we need to think about is when an organizational system creates problems, the strategies to make the changes have to, in fact, address the causes in the system. If you don't do that, then the problems repeat. And I believe that's what's happened with Columbia.
So what exactly were these recurring organizational problems?
Okay, so that brings me to the idea that kicked off this entire series. It was about halfway through last year when I first heard the term normalization of deviance and found out that it originated from the Challenger disaster. It's used to describe the gradual erosion of safety protocols.
I mean, the normalization of deviance is something that's regarded as the root cause of many complex engineering failures from the Chernobyl accident to Challenger.
That's journalist Adam Higginbotham.
it rests on the idea that in a case like this, engineers start off with an extremely strict set of requirements and rules for how things should be done safely. But then they encounter circumstances, in this case, a series of space shuttle launches, in which they find that their engineering and the way it behaves begins to depart from those strict safety parameters. But when those parameters are expanded and no fatal accident takes place, no catastrophe ensues, they begin to accept those enlarged, extended parameters as being totally okay.
Sociologist Diane Vaughan came up with a term, and today, normalization of deviance is a theory that comes up whenever you speak about the root cause of both Challenger and Columbia. And the concept really resonates for Mike Cinelli, the Columbia shuttle engineer, particularly when thinking about the recurring issue of foam strikes.
We've been flying year after year, decade after decade. We saw some minor damages from the foam, and we got more conditioned to, okay, well, if we had a little foam here and we had some damage, we didn't want that, but the vehicle came back okay, there was no structural problems. And over time, that can condition you to accept things that you shouldn't accept. It goes into the concept of normalization of deviance.
Now, Professor Vaughan was far from the only sociologist to dedicate years of research to these space shuttle disasters and to develop theories around the cause. While Diane Vaughan's focus was on organizations and how they work, others looked at human behavior and the role of the individual.
When Challenger blew up, I started collecting newspaper articles about it, and from the New York Times. I was teaching in a business school at the time, and I was teaching organizational behavior. And I used what little I was gleaning from the newspapers as evidence that what we're studying in from these textbooks is actually relevant to real life. So pay attention, students. This isn't just some theoretical exercise. This can have a real impact on your careers.
That's Mark Meyer. He's a distinguished professor of leadership at Chapman University in California. After Challenger, he started to write papers analyzing the disaster, what he at the time called the result of organizational miscommunication. But when Roger Beaujolais happened to visit his university to speak, it set him on a different track. Now, remember, Roger Beaujolais was one of those five key engineers who tried to stop the launch.
And I walked up to him. And I said, oh, hi, Mr. Beaujolais. And I went up and shook his hand. And the first thing he says, it's pronounced Beaujolais. So he corrected me immediately. I said, oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Beaujolais. I said, I want to know if you could give me some feedback on a paper I've prepared for presentation at a conference. When he took one look at the cover and he did this, he slammed it. I mean, boom, he slammed it back in my chest. And he said, you've got it all wrong. There was no miscommunication that night. We told them it was not safe to launch, and they wouldn't hear it. This was not a communication issue. This was an ethics issue.
Despite getting off to what sounded like a terribly awkward start, that interaction between Mark Meyer and Roger Beaujolais was the beginning of more than a decade-long collaboration. For years, Mark and Roger ran seminars with senior managers and executives across different industries on leadership and ethical decision-making. And something that came up again and again was,
would I have the courage to stand up and tell the truth? I'd say, no, you're missing the point. Even when I'm dealing with executives, that's their concern. Oh, what? I'm in the top 1% of my organization, and they're worried about, would I have the courage to stand up to the people above me? So you're missing the point. This isn't about whether you have the courage to stand up to them. This is about whether you have the courage and the foresight to create a system where the people beneath you have the courage to stand up to you.
Okay, so there's people who think it's all about normalization of deviance, but then there's people who think it's all about personal responsibility. Sophie, where do you sit, having heard all the different perspectives?
Yeah, okay, so I think it's clear there's no definitive theory that explains the root cause of these disasters. Normalization of deviance definitely resonates for both, But some critics of that idea feel that it lets key players off the hook. The individuals in and out of NASA, who were mainly managers, who made decisions that were critical to the outcome. Interestingly, others have shown empathy towards these managers, saying that the schedule, budget and political constraints of NASA were very real.
This sounds like one of those cases after the event, hindsight gives you 20/20 vision. If only you could have had it before the event, but you can't.
And as valuable as all this analysis is from these expert opinions, I think it's also important to go back to the people who were there, who actually lived this.
There was always the answer that we don't have enough time, we're supposed to launch.
That's Brian Russell, one of the engineers who worked for Morton Thiokol, who spoke out against the launch of Challenger on January 28, 1986.
Just the pressure to keep launching, there's a natural pressure within the program that you want to perform, that no one wants to be the one to stand up and say, I'm not ready to go, and I've got a problem I need to fix.
And this is what Brian refers to as launch fever.
When you get near a launch time, you really want to go. You want to be ready. You want to have it be successful. And so as I ponder that type of pressure, which can lead then to not resolving problems, and that how do you know which problem is going to be the one that's going to lead to a catastrophe? That is so hard to know in advance.
And this is a point that has been raised with me again and again. But this takes discipline and attention.
That's what I think is so important. But I believe it takes a constant reminder to do that and to keep that on our minds, because day to day, we lose track of those things. And that's one of the reasons I'm willing to speak, is because I just feel this is a lesson worth learning, and even learning it from the horse's mouth.
Okay, despite all those difficulties, generally speaking, the Space Shuttle program was an incredible achievement from NASA. Between 1981 and 2011, there were 133 successful missions.
Yeah, and those missions, the crews helped to build the International Space Station. They conducted many, many scientific experiments. They helped develop and test technologies. They really pushed the envelope of what space exploration could be. But when things went wrong, as we've heard in this series, it could be catastrophic.
So did NASA actually change after Columbia?
Well, maybe. In terms of NASA's culture, there's a good example of positive change, but it's definitely not without its issues. So after the Columbia disaster in 2003, the Space Shuttle program stopped for 2 years as NASA conducted investigations and tried to make sure that the space shuttles were safe, particularly with a focus on foam strikes.
So it would have been 2005 when NASA was set to launch again?
Yeah.
3, 2, 1... And liftoff of Space Shuttle Discovery, beginning America's new journey to the moon, Mars, and beyond. And the vehicle has cleared the tower.
The Space Shuttle Discovery on its way.
There was a lot of attention and anxiety surrounding that return to flight mission in 2005.
Okay, hi, my name is Eileen Collins. I'm a retired Air Force colonel, and I'm also the former commander of the STS-114 mission, which was the return to flight mission after the Columbia space shuttle accident.
How much pressure was on that return to flight mission for it to be successful?
It's tremendous, tremendous amount of pressure. Like the whole, not just the whole country, the whole world was watching us. And the space shuttle program, the whole program in itself was under scrutiny. If we had failed, the program could have been canceled.
How did you feel about commanding that next flight?
I was very confident. I was very honored, and I felt very well prepared to fly the mission and to be the commander of the mission.
Did you feel satisfied that issues like the phone strike issue had been resolved?
We were not 100% confident that every 100% potential issues were 100% perfect. That's not the case. That would never be the case in a risky business like spaceflight. That would not be the case. The question is it fixed to your satisfaction? And that's why we have risk management programs.
But this return to flight mission was far from straightforward. Because although NASA had thought that they'd fixed the foam strike issue, it turned out they hadn't. And just like during the Columbia launch, a piece of foam fell off the external fuel tank.
So this happened on the very next launch after Columbia?
Yes, but this time NASA dealt with the problem very differently. For a start, management was transparent about what had happened, particularly with the crew, and they were told,
"We need to continue to investigate this incident to make sure you don't have any damage."
As opposed to the previous response where they said, "We do not think this is a major problem. We've had foam strikes in the past."
Exactly. What was it like receiving that news that there had been a potential foam strike?
So at the time, I did not let that bother me very much because I had a mission to execute. I knew that everybody on the ground is paying attention to this, but I knew that this was going to be a huge issue down on planet Earth. And I knew that people were very upset. I knew people were surprised, ashamed, but no one would cover anything up. That's just something, I mean, you don't do that because you can't. So everything is going to be out there. And I felt like I was in good hands. I didn't want my crew to worry, but I made sure my crew knew about it.
And the other difference was this time, photos were taken to double check if the foam had damaged the vehicle. So on re-entry, despite what had happened to Columbia 2 years prior, Eileen says she felt confident commanding the shuttle back to Earth.
It was just before sunrise when we landed. It was a big relief that the mission was over. We were obviously happy that we made it back safely and successfully.
But back on land, Eileen and her crew reckon with the fact that the same problem occurred despite all the work that had been done to prevent foam strikes.
A decision was made to not change that part of the fuel tank due to engineering analysis, and it was an incorrect decision. So now we have to go back and fix that.
Wow, so it was unbelievable that the foam strike issue that was found to be the cause of the Columbia disaster struck again, and right away too, on the very first return to flight after a 2-year delay.
But culturally, the way that that problem was dealt with was potentially evidence that there had been a shift. Glass half full?
I'm liking it. It's now 4 decades since the Challenger disaster, 2 decades since the Columbia. Have these changes stuck?
In the final episode of the Challenger Legacy, we look to the future, to the Artemis missions and beyond.
It's a mission more than 5 decades in the making. NASA's Artemis II, sending astronauts around the moon for the first time since Apollo 17 in 1972.
I think I've got a good eye for launch fever. I'm not going to tell the agency that I'm ready to go fly until I think we're ready to go fly.
NASA is trying to do too much, and that's of great concern to me, especially as we look toward these Artemis missions.
This all began, call it just about 9 years ago. President Trump established the Artemis program, committed America to returning to the moon.
That's on episode 5, the final episode of The Challenger Legacy.
Science Friction, The Challenger Legacy was made for ABC Radio National on the lands of the Gadigal and Menang Noongar people. It's reported and presented by me, Fiona Pepper.
And with me, Carl Krushnitsky. The show's senior producer is James Bullen, and our sound engineer is Timothy Jenkins. Now, if you've been enjoying the Challenger Legacy series, please remember to tell your friends and leave us a review. It all helps people find us. We've got a special episode on the topic on YouTube, so search for the ABC Science YouTube channel.
Oh, and before you go, we'll be doing a special episode of the Challenger Legacy, taking your questions for Dr. Carl and I to answer. It'll go out in a couple of weeks' time, and we want to answer as many of your questions as possible. So if you have one about Challenger or Columbia, the space shuttle program, the Artemis missions, or the science of space exploration, send it in. You can reach us on sciencefriction@abc.net.au or via the ABC Radio National homepage. Catch you next time.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.